and welcome to Batflips and Nerds, the baseball podcast with a British twist. My guest for this evening is a well-known presence on British and American baseball Twitter, a man who spent 3 months this summer and his life savings chasing a dream and taking in 75 professional baseball games across two continents and thousands of grueling miles. My friend and yours, the man with the tash, it's Baseball Brit, Joey Mellows. How are you, Joey?
Hello, John. No, you're smashing, mate. Thanks ever so much for having us on.
An absolute pleasure, mate. So let's take the bull by the horn straight away before we get into the real substance of this. Where's the mo gone, mate? And is it coming back soon?
Yeah, just an update on the moustache. I did have it yesterday. There's a picture up on Twitter where I have it on Sunday, but it's gone today. I'm going back to work on Thursday, so no messing about. And it's not been too kind to me with the ladies.
I was going to ask, why was it that it mysteriously disappeared in the middle of the trip? I wondered if it was a Hunter S. Thompson style hallucination in the middle of the Mojave Desert, and you thought, I've just got to get rid of the tash. But it was the ladies, was it?
Yeah, I mean, it was the ladies. Most of them found it repulsive, and the ones that did enjoy it tended to be fairly interesting as people. Quirky and a little bit too kinky for my liking. So yeah, it went, it came back, and unfortunately now it's gone.
Yeah, and probably for professional reasons, it sounds like it was a wise and sage decision, mate. So we won't judge you for that.
Thank you, John.
That's all right. So to move on to the substance of the conversation, obviously you've been back how long now? A couple of weeks?
I've been back, yeah, I think 3 or 4 weeks now. It's taken a while to get the visa sorted for China, so that's why I'm still here.
Okay, and you're off to China later this week to go and spend some time in the beautiful Macau. I guess you're back there teaching again, am I right?
That's right, yeah. Coming in as a kind of fireman reliever for Dulwich College. A couple of teachers have let them down, so I got the call and I'm back out there just for 5 months, and the contract ends just as the baseball season starts, which is not a coincidence.
Well, we'll come on to that. We'll come on to that later on. So let's talk about this adventure before we start planning the next one, shall we? So you did 75 games this season, Joey, and I wondered how you started with 75. Was that an aim that you set for yourself, or was it, was that just a sort of idle guess that you were sort of just plucked a number out of thin air, really?
A bit of both. I thought 70, around about 70, was realistically what I could expect to achieve with time. I didn't finish work till near the end of June, so there was the time element to it. But also 73 was the target I set originally, purely because it's a baseball number, Barry Bonds' home run record, and I wanted to beat that. For just a personal, it's a silly thing. So 74 was what I set myself, but meeting Russell in Cleveland at the end pushed me up to 75, which I'm pretty pleased with, to be honest.
Yeah, it's a pretty extraordinary number, and it's, it's not an even number, but it's a nice round number, and it's a good place to be a jumping off point for next time. So you were all over the place, actually. You sent me your schedule earlier on today, and I knew it roughly, but looking back on it, it really does lay bare that there was a lot of method in there, and I know that you spent lots and lots of nights assiduously planning exactly what your trip was going to be. But how and why did you decide to go where you did? Was it, just sort of a secondary question to that is that I know you changed quite a lot. So, I mean, why did you decide where to go in the first place, and what prompted you to change, other than Russell, obviously, just demanding that you come to Cleveland?
Yeah, you're right. There did, there was a lot of thought that went into it. The first game was in Nagoya in Japan, and that was between Australia and Team Japan, the Samurai. And I've actually got bat flips. I've got you, John, to thank for that, because you guys got me into the Australian Baseball League with your off-season podcasts after the World Series last year. And through the ABL, I was able to watch that due to the time difference being very similar from South Korea, where I previously lived. And I got to know some of the broadcasters and some of the players, remarkably, including Josh Tolles, who I interviewed for Bat Flips back last December. And Josh was able to, tell me about the game in Japan and said he'd be able to get me a ticket in the end through Todd Van Steensel. And because I was in Seoul, it was easy to fly over. So that was game one. And that was back on March the 2nd or 3rd. And after that, I knew I had to finish work. I went to some Korean games, but I didn't want, 25% of the entire 75 being Korean games. So I think I only went to 9 KBO games at the start of the season, and then flew to Texas, which has always been my starting point in the USA. I used to coach soccer in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and it's an area of the USA that I'm fairly familiar with. So we flew into Houston to start with a team that I thought would be contending come the end of the season, which is the World Series, Astros. And I also saw a lot of the Red Sox, as it turned out. So I flew in to see Kansas City, which are my team, play the Houston Astros, and that's where it started. And I drove up from there to Chicago.
Yeah, that's a pretty long old schlep. We'll come on to that. But so from Houston, you spent time, I think your first, because the original idea was that you were going to spend a lot of time watching indie ball, and indeed you did. But the first place you went was Sugarland. And I think, if I remember from the conversations we've had, it turned out to be one of your favourite places that you went. Is that right?
That's right. So of the 75 games, 39 of them were independent baseball. And it was great to start off in Houston. I flew in having run a half marathon on the morning of the flight. And I did that deliberately to try and get some sleep on the plane. So I'm not very good at sleeping on planes, and I knew we'd be arriving late into Houston. I think I put it on Twitter recently, but from flying from Atlanta, where we landed from Seoul, we flew to Houston. We had to take an internal flight, and Deshaun Watson, the quarterback for the Houston Texans, was sat about two rows in front of me. So that was a really good omen to kind of start the summer. And we got to our hotel in downtown Houston about 1 a.m. And I had to report to work, I think, about 9:30 the next morning. So it was a pretty relentless schedule that first day. But yeah, Sugarland was really where I was able to kind of catch up on a bit of sleep, see my first independent game, and was just bowled over by the hospitality shown. And that was a trait that repeated itself consistently throughout the trip.
Yeah, well, I'm going to ask you about some of your favourite places in a moment. But just coming back to that flexibility, what was driving it? I know that some of it was personality driven. So you mentioned Josh Tolles already, but I know that you headed up to Winnipeg in Canada to meet Alex Boshiers, which I don't think was in the schedule to start with. And you circled back to Kansas City and St. Paul to see our friend and former podcast guest Dan Vaughan and the Kansas City T-Bones in the playoffs as well, didn't you?
That's right. And just to give the listeners an overview of, you know, what the journey entailed, I started in Japan, saw some games in Korea, flew to Houston in southern Texas. From there, I went up towards Kansas City, through Texas, of course, and Oklahoma, and then flew from Kansas City to Chicago. Then I had a wedding back in France. My cousins are French, so I had to fly back for about 9 days and attend the wedding, see my niece, who was 6 months old, that I'd not met yet. And then I flew from London to California, to Oakland. And that was deliberately to see the Pacific Association, which was where the Sonoma Stompers from The Only Rule Is It Has to Work, book by Ben Lindbergh and Sam Miller, was written. So that's why I was out in California. From then, we flew to Arizona, because that was the only way really to tick off that major league ballpark, en route to Pittsburgh. From Pittsburgh, I drove out to the East Coast, to Philadelphia. Then my friend Andy Brown departed to go back to work. And that's really where, you know, another 10 weeks adventure started for me, where I drove from the East Coast all the way up to Winnipeg in Canada, and then from there all the way across to Denver in Colorado. And then there was a mad kind of journey, but trying to get back to the East Coast so I could get back to London and get this visa sorted out for this job that suddenly appeared in China.
And what was it like when you met the likes of Josh and Alex and Dan? It must have been pretty surreal for you and for them, having interacted through Twitter and, you know, started off as a, you know, just a fan of the ABL as we were, you know, sort of this time last year.
Yeah, it was probably more weird with Dan, because I'd not conversed with him much from the Australian baseball season ending in February to meeting him in a press room in July. Josh and Alex I'd kept in touch with on WhatsApp, and I used to ring them once or twice a month, probably for about 3 or 4 months, just to find out how they were doing. Josh was signed originally to the Winnipeg Goldeyes in independent baseball in March, and then got signed by the Phillies a couple of days later, ended up being in Florida at their training camp there for a long time, went to the Clearwater Threshers, eventually got up to AA. So by the time I met him, I mean, that was part of the reason the journey became less planned, was because I never knew where Josh was going to be, and I was determined to see him. So when he got called up to the Reading Fighting Phils at the AA level, I was able to, you know, to change a few plans and make sure that I saw him for a couple of days. And the first game I saw Josh pitch, well, Josh didn't pitch in the first game. So again, I changed my plans because I didn't want to, you know, have spent all that money and all that time trying to watch Tolsey pitch. So I stayed another day, and thankfully he came in about the seventh and eighth inning and actually got his first win for the organisation that night. Nice. So that was special for me to catch up with him and his girlfriend Lindsay, who I'd also been in contact with.
Great. And Canada, that was all to chase Alex Bouchers, wasn't it? To go all the way, because Canada wasn't originally on the schedule either, was it?
Canada, in hindsight, John, was a big mistake because I was in Fargo. And I was meant to be heading down to Sioux Falls. The Sioux Falls Canaries are a team in the American Association of Independent Baseball. But I foolishly looked at a map and I had no idea that I was so close to the Canadian border, about 3.5 hours away. And I thought this could be the only time in my life I get the chance to head to Canada. And I knew Alex was pitching. And as I said, I've been in contact with him and was determined to try and watch him in action. So I just hopped in the car, drove straight to the border, didn't Google about, you know, any kind of visa stuff. Just hoped that the British passport would get me through. And then I got detained by their police for about 2 hours and had to stand in front of my car with my hands on my head whilst they searched it and looked for drugs all along the plastic sideboards and things. Had my laptop scanned for goodness knows what. And I wasn't sure I was actually going to get allowed into the country. But the big sticking point was the Mountie, or the police officer, the Canadian police officer that stopped me, his father was British. And he did not buy the fact that I was heading to Canada to watch the Winnipeg Goldeyes, because he said people in Britain don't care about baseball. So he was looking for drugs, and it's probably the moustache again did not help.
But you did get up there eventually.
I got up there and spent 3 days there, and it was a fantastic organisation. Really big crowds up in Winnipeg. The general manager there, Andrew Collier, really looked after me. You know, did far more than he needed to, and I, you know, that was a highlight of the trip, really, just going up there spontaneously to see Alex and see Canada for the first time.
Excellent. That's brilliant. So staying with that theme, I wanted to talk about your highlights. And you suggested to me that I ask you about these in top three format. So I've taken that suggestion and run with it. So some of your suggestions are in there, and I've added to that some of my own. So let's start with the top three clubs that you visited over the course of your 75-game schlep.
Oh boy, top three clubs is very difficult indeed, because a bit of a cop out, but every single ballpark I went to and every single team were incredibly welcoming, and it was new and it was exciting, and I got to experience things that, you know, the average fan might not be able to experience in terms of going to lockers and speaking to managers, and the access was incredible. But if forced, I would have to say my favourite team I saw were the Sugarland Skeeters. That was my first experience of independent baseball. I had a hunch, and it was quite a big hunch in terms of the money I'd invested, that I would love independent baseball. But until I got there to Constellation Field, their home ground, just outside of Houston in the suburbs there, I wasn't sure whether this whole summer was a crazy, ridiculous idea and this money should be going on a house mortgage. So the Skeeters for me was just, I sat there, they got me right behind home plate. And the quality of baseball in the Atlantic League is phenomenally high. I was blown away by the quality and the atmosphere. And, you know, it's a balmy night in southern Texas. So, you know, there's all kinds of craziness going on. Sugarland Skeeters is number one, I'd say, for me. Number two, it would be the Sonoma Stompers. And again, I think this is partly because I'm a fanboy of the book, The Only Rule Is It Has to Work. I'd read all about these players and the people that work there and the area. It's a very posh area. It was one, probably the most expensive hotel for the whole trip was in Sonoma. But I got to meet lots of people from the book, including Theo Fightmaster. Yeah, had a couple of beers with him, went out for a Cuban lunch, and just the fanboy element of it, I was just wow the whole time. We also went out with their new general manager, Brett Creamer. He's only 26, after a walk-off victory as well on a Sunday, a balmy Sunday, when they had it was Bark in the Park Day as a promotion. So we had Baja Men, Who Let the Dogs Out, blaring out, and all these people were walking dogs around the bases before the start. It was the first game that Theo Fightmaster had come back to since he left his GM. So it was special to kind of sit with him and, you know, have a beer and just enjoy the game. And it was a cracking game. Travis Blackley, his team, the Pittsburgh Diamonds, were playing. And I was hoping to interview Travis, so I know you've interviewed John, but I called out to their outfielder from the bleachers, "Where's Travis?" And apparently he hadn't turned up. I'm not sure whether he has to turn up on Sundays, but he was the assistant coach, so I was a bit bemused.
How confusing.
Yeah, so Sonoma Stompers was number two. And then number three for me, I'm a Kansas City fan, and I'd never been to see a game at Kauffman. I tried in April, but it got frozen off. So, you know, going to Kauffman, albeit it's in a car park, I'm not going to pretend it's a super glamorous ballpark, but once you're inside, it's fantastic. And I saw them lose twice consecutively against the Red Sox. And then eventually we got our first win against the Twins. So that was a highlight for me on Thursday, the 13th of September.
Excellent. And following on from that, what about the top three ballparks? It's sort of a spin on the clubs, but I'm assuming there were some places that, you know, the club was maybe less of an experience than the ballpark. You can pick the same three if you want, but this gives you an opportunity to cop out and pick some more.
They're very different. And I know a lot of the listeners are more into the Major League Baseball. So I'm going to keep this Major League Baseball. Number three, I should say Kauffman Stadium is the best as a Royals fan. But keeping that out of the equation, number three was actually the Cardinals. So I can be, fair. Busch Stadium, downtown location, really nice kind of area they've got outside where you can have some beers before you head in, and fantastic views from everywhere. So Busch Stadium was number three. Coors Field with the Rockies was number two. Again, a downtown location, which I tend to favour, I think. The Mile High seats, the purple row of seats that go along a mile above the ground. I sat in one of those. And it was Zach Greinke that was pitching for the D-backs. So he's one of my favourite players. From that point of view, it was special to spend a couple of games at Coors Field. Number one is controversial. And you can come at me on Twitter, I don't mind. But my favourite ballpark of the whole summer was the Coliseum for the Oakland Athletics.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to say Three Rivers, but there you go.
No, I absolutely loved it, John. It's crumbling. It's falling apart. It was leaking from the roof. And one of the ladies who worked there said, be careful not to tread in that puddle. It's oil or something. I met a friend there from my time in London who now works at Berkeley, which is very nearby, and I was able to catch up with him. Andy was able to paint in the stand. We'd met a couple of guys earlier that week in San Francisco, so they came with us, and they played the Blue Jays, and they absolutely whooped them. And it was the first time I'd kind of sat up and thought, wow, these Athletics could be a sneaky good team this season, because I had not expected them to be going into the start of the season.
Well, you obviously hadn't been listening to Darius, but he was only going on about Matt Chapman, so you know.
I need to listen to Darius more. Yeah, he talks.
What about your top three games that you attended out of the 75, if you can narrow it down that far?
I can. I think. My third favourite game was the one I've touched on earlier, where the Royals beat the Minnesota Twins 6-4. I was worried that I was a curse. I was worried that I was going to get a reputation as a curse. The Kansas City Royals have a famous Korean fan who kind of got on board as they won their first World Series since 1985. And I'd been featured in the newspaper there, and some of the fans had said, oh, I was there for two losses, so I'm a curse. And I really didn't want, to get banned from my favorite team's ballpark. So that was relief, really, when the Royals beat the Twins 6-4. Second favorite was... It was Double A, actually, minor league baseball, the Reading Fighting Phils. They were up against the Binghamton Rumble Ponies, and they won 4-3, a really, really close game on a Saturday night. It was packed in there. Must have been 9,000-10,000 people. It's got an old feel, their ballpark. It often features high in the top 10 baseball America ballparks. And Toldy came in and got the win, as I talked about earlier, and he threw some junk. He was throwing like some 63-mile-per-hour curveballs. So it was incredible to sit up in the press box. I made a couple of friends up there and watch someone who I knew and had spoken to for several months put on a fantastic performance in front of a Saturday night crowd. And after that, I went out on the beers with one of their closers, and we had a pretty wild night. So that was another reason that was a highlight. Number one, though, Pittsburgh Diamonds at Sonoma Stompers. This was the game, again, I've touched on with, Theo Schneidmaster came back. Travis Blackley, the elusive Travis Blackley, I wasn't able to catch up with him, and it was a walk-off in the ninth, obviously, 11-9. The Stompers won it, and after that, it was a lunchtime game, so we got back and then headed out with their GM and a few of their players and painted the town red that night.
Excellent. I imagine that was a pretty expensive one. I was over in Sonoma and Napa a couple of months ago, and it's not the cheapest place I've ever been to. So I hope that you weren't putting your hand in your pocket too much.
I drink Miller Lite, John, so thankfully my unsophisticated palate saves me some money there. But yeah, you're right, it's pricey, but worth going to. Definitely worth checking out Napa and Sonoma, lovely places.
Yeah, absolutely. I would fundamentally agree with that. So this one might be a bit of a difficult one. You've touched on some people already, but I wanted to ask you about the top three players or people you met along the way. I know you've been keeping us up to date, and you've mentioned some of these people already, I guess, that you'll come back to. But if you can narrow it down to three, who were the people who really made an impression on you and really helped you out?
That is very tough. I guess if I can group these people together, some of the fans, the season ticket holders, particularly for these teams where, Texas Air Hogs in Arlington on a Sunday night, there were 50 fans there. But there were season ticket holders, and it was fantastic to kind of sit with them and message them beforehand, and, learn about the area and the players, the team, watch a game with them. So Carrie over in over at the Texas Air Hogs, I met Jen, is a house mum up in Fargo, and she essentially houses players. For those that don't know much about indie ball, lots of the players stay with host families, and she's in charge of organising all the host families for all the players that play for the Fargo Moorhead Redhawks. So talking to her and watching a game and learning about, the routines of the players, not just when they get to the ballpark when I'm there and play the game, but when they're away from the game. And learning what they do at home in terms of their routine was fascinating. Ethan, I think you've been in touch with. I've played catch with Ethan in Springfield. He's writing each day. He plays catch with a different person, so 365 days, different people throwing catch with. That was the first time I'd ever actually put a baseball mitt on.
Oh,
So
wow.
meeting him was wonderful down in Springfield, southern Missouri. Ryan at Wichita Wingnuts. Wichita Wingnuts are no longer a team. Hopefully, we'll talk about them later. This is the sort of transient nature of independent baseball. They're disappearing as the Baby Cakes, the Miami Marlins AAA franchise, get moved up there for 2020 once the new ballpark's built. I'm sure I've missed lots of people off. Kevin and Kevin Luco and Robert Pannier from This Week in the Association. It's a podcast for the American Association of Independent Baseball. They looked after me all summer. And they're blokes that I'm looking forward to seeing next summer as well. So yeah, the fans, the local fans. Number two, Joey Zanaboni. If you don't know who Joey Zanaboni is, please do get on his Twitter. There's not many people called Joey Zanaboni, so you should be able to find him. But he's the play-by-play guy for the Texas Air Hogs, and his style is very different from anything you've ever heard in terms of baseball commentary. He comes up with all kinds of, one-liners and things to bring some comedy to the proceedings. But he's a fantastic sports broadcaster as well. So meeting him. He's a real character. You should check out his videos on Twitter in order to understand what I'm talking about. Number one, probably Theo Fightmaster. I've mentioned him already, but he was so kind, and he was, they say, don't meet people that you look up to or your heroes, or whatever. Having read the book, he was someone I was so excited to meet, and he was everything and more I could have hoped for. And I learned so much about the Pacific Association, from 3 hours with him. The ins and outs, and the good and the bad, and his own experiences with Sonoma. So yeah, Theo, I'd say number one.
So the last thing before we move on to the next section, I wanted to ask you about like your top three wild cards. So that's like interviews, experiences, bizarre people that you met that sort of just fell into your lap. What about those? Because I know there are a few of them.
I mean, no, I don't mean to say this chap's bizarre, but I met Rafael Palmeiro. That's probably number three. Up in Cleburne, Texas, I got ushered into a room and was told that Rafael was waiting for a strange British person he'd heard was on the way to to learn about baseball. So I got to speak to him about why he was playing baseball at the age of 53, and he talked passionately about the game, about the fact he was so happy to be playing with his son, who was also on the same team. And I asked him why he shaved off the moustache and things, and whether he was thinking of getting it back. So it's quite a light-hearted little interview, but he was very kind and a lot shorter than I was expecting, but in terrific shape, John. Fitter than a butcher's dog, certainly a lot fitter than me. And at the age of 53, that was something to experience. Number two, I got to throw out a first pitch in Gary. Gary's a town in Indiana. It's where Michael Jackson's born, actually, but very near Chicago. And one night they just said, I've been there for the previous game, and they said, right, it's the office. It's a special promo tonight, the office, and we're going to get you, thrown out the first pitch. And I got up on the mound, never thrown a baseball from, you know, from the mound to home plate before, and kind of, I don't know what you call it, a knuckle slurve. It was slow and it wobbled and it died horrifically at the end. And it came off my, I don't know, my fingernails or something. It was dreadful, but just about got there, and the catcher made it look a little bit better and framed it for me fairly nicely. But that was something I wasn't expecting to do. And the old heart was pounding. There were probably only about 500 people watching. Yeah, that's not something I was expecting to do on the trip. Number one, what's the question? A weird experience for number one.
Yeah.
Something bizarre that happened. Okay. Number one, bizarre thing that happened. Oh, boy. I mean, probably, it was probably meeting Rustin Dodd.
Yeah, I was going to say, you were sort of one of the top stories on The Athletic for a day or so. That was a bit
that
weird.
That was weird, yeah. And it was weird how I met him. I met him in Houston the very first day that I was in the USA for this trip. I was exhausted after, you know, flying from Korea, which was about an 18, 19 hour flight with a changeover. And his laptop wasn't working in the press box. So I just said, I'll be honest, I'm not really sure, you know, that I need to use mine. Would you like to use my laptop? And he heard the accent. We got talking. I obviously, as a KC fan, knew that he wrote about the Royals a lot. And that's how we met. And then 2 or 3 weeks later, I was in Kansas City. And he messaged me on Twitter and said, you know, fancy a beer before the game. And I just went and met him, and we had a Boulevard beer each, and wasn't really expecting to be interviewed. But yeah, he spoke to me and asked lots of questions, very personal questions, actually, about, you know, about my background and what I was doing over here. And then he wrote it up the next day, and he included a word in the write up, wanker, which I had said, which, you know, my parents had never heard me swear, John. So I was terrified that my mum was going to read it. But thankfully, she doesn't have a subscription. It was behind a paywall. No, but I do. Yeah. So I don't think she's read it, or my dad's read it, or my sister. None of them really into baseball. But meeting him was fantastic. And just the exposure, it kind of legitimized the trip at an early point, which then I think it helped with some of the access I got later on in the summer. So that was the weirdest and probably the best thing that happened to me in terms of making the trip very successful.
Great. So moving on from some of the highlights, I wanted to ask you about some of the reality of the trip, which was, you know, I guess it was a bit of a grind sometimes. So I'm going to read out some of the driving times that you sent through to me earlier on today. 5 hours, 4 hours, 49, 4 hours, 40, 8 hours, 8 minutes, 6 hours and 9 hours, 17, at the end of which you actually went to a baseball game as opposed to, you know, drop down dead. I want to ask how on earth you actually managed that. I mean, was it sort of force of will, I guess?
It was, yeah, I mean, this trip was about baseball predominantly, but it was also, I guess, about adventure. And I've always been a dreadful driver. I didn't pass my test till I was 25. I went to university in London, so I always had an excuse that I didn't really need to have a car for a long time. But I was very old when I passed. And I've never been very good at driving. So I'm actually really proud of those days when I was in the car for 6 hours. And that became almost a regular thing. And it was fine in the car. I had a really good car. I think it was a Hyundai Santa Fe. So it's like an SUV thing. And it's automatic, obviously. The roads out there are very wide, very different to Portsmouth, where it's so narrow you can only get one car down at a time. But in the car, I managed to get a wire where you can put your phone into the, you know, people listening thinking, geez, you know, this is 10 years ago. But the first time I've ever actually been able to connect my phone to the car. So suddenly these long drives became, you know, I was able to listen to all the Bat Flips podcasts, all the other baseball British podcasts, which I'm not sure I should name here or not.
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Absolute bunts. LA John and Henry and possibly Russell. So, got to listen to
Russell.
Yeah, I got to listen to all of these podcasts that I hadn't listened to for a long time. I mean, you've got so many episodes now. I was able to go through your back catalogue, and I really enjoy getting in the car and you know, listening to these various podcasts and having my old pop punk emo music on. So the driving in itself became something I actually added more long drives in. I'm very happy on my own. I've lived on my own for 10 years, so that wasn't anything that fazed me. The only thing that did faze me was the worry that the car would break down because I didn't have a phone that worked out there. As you've realized tonight, you still can't ring. I've still got a Korean number. I don't have a SIM card in England. I didn't have a SIM card in the States. So there was always that fear. If I break down, I've got no way of getting, you know, help unless I stop a truck driver. And I've seen a lot of movies, so I wasn't going to do that anytime soon. But no, the driving in the end became fun. I enjoyed it.
That's really interesting. And what about the accommodation? I know you wrote in your article for us that, you know, you had to be careful not to max out your budget other than that overnight stay in Sonoma that was probably about, you know, $800. Any real flea pits? Any times when you thought, you know, Leatherface is going to break down the door, or I'm going to be in the middle of a drug deal or anything like that?
No, definitely. I've had a few really, you know, kind of nervous experiences, I guess, with the hotels I'm staying in. And if you're doing things on a budget, which I had to, I stayed in, and this isn't a knock on Motel 6, I stayed in quite a few Motel 6s. Most of them were great, but I stayed in one in Fort Wayne, Indiana, which is a fairly small town in itself. And I got there and there was, you know, what looked like poo stained into the carpet, cockroaches in the showers. There was some sort of domestic thing going on outside my door. There were people doing drugs very openly in the car park. And yeah, that became a worry. That was £32 for the night. So can't really complain, to be honest.
But
I got to the Tin Caps ballpark and I kind of explained, you know, they said, where are you staying? And I told them about 6 miles outside near downtown. And they, you know, I could see the GM wince, Mike Nutter. And their play-by-play offered, you know, you can sleep, you know, I could come back to his apartment and, you know, sleep in the lounge. But I thought, no, I've got to tough this out. So I got back. I drove back. And as I drove back, there were two cop cars circling this Motel 6. So I kind of just rushed in. The bed was filthy, so I slept in a jumper and got out of there at about 4 a.m. And just carried on the journey. But it was one of the best ballpark experiences. But you know, so sometimes you got to have the rough with the smooth. It was probably the worst hotel experience. But Vallejo in California, another one. I was seeing the Vallejo Admirals. The only game on the whole trip of 75 where we turned up late. I messed up the timing with the West Coast time zone, so we got there in about the third inning. So I didn't see the whole game. But there was a pimp sat in the hotel lobby, and he saw all the people that worked behind the desk because they were chatting very, you know, they seemed like they were friends or whatever. And there were all these girls, let's say, in the car park. And, you know, the pimp was very friendly. He, you know, he made a very good offer to me, but I had to turn him down and upset, you know, one of the girls, I think, by just saying that. Well, I had to pretend actually I was gay because I was staying with Andy. Andy was still with me, and he was getting the bags out of the car. And I went into the hotel lobby, and this chap spoke to me and propositioned me with a business offer, let's say. And I had to come up with something. So that was it. And yeah, I'm not sure that helped. I think that made things more uncomfortable for the rest of the stay because the guys behind the, you know, the desk were then a little bit worried. But again, we had a lovely time in Vallejo, so no knock on that. And that's where CC Sabathia is from. That's his hometown. I know he gives a lot of money back to the area. So it was nice to see that part of California as well.
Great. I want to touch on, you've already touched on it yourself, the psychological side of the trip. Obviously, you've mentioned a couple of times now that you spent the first chunk or the first tranche of games with Andy, who, for those who don't know, paints absolutely wonderful pictures of ballparks. But then there was a lot of time on your own. So how did you cope with that transition when you left Andy? You sort of did the sort of Disney film where the end of Titanic, where your hands part, and then you were off on your own. I mean, it must have taken quite a lot of fortitude and personal resilience to sort of crack on after that, did it?
I know Andy's going to be listening to this, so this is, you know, no offense, mate, but I was pumped. I was really excited about, you know, having, you know, the trip to myself, I guess, for the next 10 weeks or whatever it was. Andy is someone that I got to know in Seoul in South Korea, and we went to baseball together. He was the only other British guy that really went regularly. So he is my only British friend in terms of baseball that I go and watch games with. His circumstances changed. So he was never meant to be with me for about, I think he was with me for 4 weeks in total in the end. But he was only meant to be with me for 2 weeks, and that was going to be sort of like late July time, and that was going to be like a holiday period where we could, you know, just catch up and hit the beers and watch some baseball, and he could paint some ballparks. But his circumstances changed, and he ended up coming out with me for the first two weeks. So we'd been with each other for about a month, you know, living in the same hotel room, two double beds in the hotel room, sharing the car journeys, and it was fantastic because he's a good friend. We've got lots of things in common, and we had a lovely time. But the trip became, from the start, unfortunately, a holiday in my mind, because I was there with, you know, one of my best friends. So when he left, I was quite excited because I thought, here we go, it's going to turn professional at last, and I'm going to knuckle down and, you know, and do all this writing and stuff that I'd said to you and Tom I'd do. And it didn't turn out that way in the end either. So yeah, I need to apologize to Andy really, because at the time I thought, oh, it's because Andy's here, we're on holiday mode. But I think to be honest, the thing that was difficult about this trip, and someone asked the question about tips and things, is I think I was never in a place for long enough. So whereas normally if you're, you know, a beat reporter, you go away with a team and it's a 3-game series, maybe a 4-game series. You have that time where you can kind of settle at least in one hotel room. Whereas I was on the move pretty much every other day, if not every day. And therefore there's that, you've got to check out by 11 in the morning, and there's that rush to, you know, to check out, so to speak. You can't check in till 3. You've got the drive to do. You've got to try and get some food, you know, all that stuff. The people, the ballpark you're heading to, get your laundry done, try and find some clean underwear. You know, there's all these things that, you know, get over the hangover that you've got. So there was all this stuff happening, and Andy left and I was fine, because as I said, I'm used to being on my own, and it was great. Both aspects, being with someone and also having some time on my own. I enjoyed both of them.
And you've been back, as you said earlier on in the conversation, for about 3 or 4 weeks. How has the sort of transition been, the weaning yourself off baseball?
It's been, I haven't weaned myself off it, John, to be honest. I've been up, because I'm not working at the moment. I've been staying up till 10 o'clock for the first game, and then, you know, trying to stay up for 1 o'clock for the second game. If I haven't stayed up, then I've been waking up at 6 in the morning, just as I'm sure the game's then finished on MLB TV, so I can click on it without it suddenly going to the 13th inning or something. So I've been watching all the games in the morning. I'm sure my parents are fed up with me. I'm ringing you at the moment from my old bedroom where I've lived since the age of 0. So it's been great to come home and spend some time with my family, who I've not seen really for, you know, 4 years or so, for this length of time. So yeah, I mean, it's just an extension of the summer, really. I'm very fortunate, and it's been a lovely time, but I'm quite excited now to get back to work, and I'm sure they're excited to not have to watch baseball with me every night on TV in the lounge.
Yeah, well, I think my girlfriend would agree with that. So we're going to move on. We put out a call for some listener questions, and we've had a few. Obviously, you didn't have any confidence in my questions, because you went and asked everybody else again. So we've got a few more than we had earlier on.
Oh, okay.
No, I'm joking, man. We've got a few here, some good questions, some of which we've touched on a bit. So if I'm not asking your question, it's probably because we've already covered it. It doesn't mean it was a bad question. But these ones I thought were really interesting and might offer something different. So the first question is from Matt Clough. Any tips on doing a trip like this and not bankrupting yourself?
Yes, Matt. Yeah, I do have some tips. The first tip I'd say is, if you're able to go for a period of time, embrace social media. It's something, I'm so glad I joined Twitter last November and started making contacts early. The earlier you contact people, the more they end up trusting you, I guess, and the more legitimate you seem. Save money regularly if you can. That's an obvious one. Get a cheap car. The best car probably I had all summer was a Nissan Versa in grey. It was one of the least attractive cars for anyone to look at, but it was cheap and it was fine. So, you know, don't spend money unnecessarily on a big car. I'd also, you know, check out things such as convert air miles, see if you've got any credit card points that you can use for hotels. I did that, I think, for 4 nights. I was able to use some stuff on a credit card to pay for a nice hotel in Milwaukee and also in St. Louis. And then I started towards the end, John and Matt, I started just going to Walmart and buying like a plastic cereal bowl and some cutlery. And I'd buy obviously cereal and some bread, some peanut butter. And some nights every meal would just be cereal in the car with a carton of milk that I'd buy from a garage and then dispose of, recycling, obviously. So, yeah, those are some tips. Save early, get in touch with people early, and don't be ashamed to just eat cereal 2 or 3 times a day.
I certainly am not. Not that I've done it very recently, but I've certainly done it plenty. I'm not going to chastise you for that. The next question is from the man with whom you spent your final evening on your trip, and who I'm sure will be very disappointed that he was not in the top 3 people that you met. The man of this parish, absolutely not Absolute Bunts Parish, Russell Eason. He wanted to ask, and you've already touched on some of this, but you'll have a chance to elaborate about how inviting the fans and the communities were around all the teams that you visited.
Yeah, lovely to spend time with Big Russell, by the way. The fans were, in a word, very, you know, they were very inviting to answer the question. I didn't really have any troubles the whole trip. You know, I've touched on the fact, you know, the Pimpen Vallejo I've written down here. You know, that was an interesting one. The only real trouble I got in the whole trip, because the fans were all inviting, even the ones that initially were a bit frosty, as I'll explain now. But the only trouble I got in was when I was at a game and I bought a very overpriced beer and an overpriced hot dog. You know that you're going to pay more than you should. But the chap basically told me that I had to leave my change. He just put my change straight above this kind of tip jar, which was for veterans, you know, Vietnam veterans. And I was just kind of taken a little bit by surprise that I didn't even have the option to, you know, to leave my own tip. Maybe I'd have left more, for example. But he could hear the English accent as well. And he kind of spoke to me. He's like, this is what you do here, son. It kind of put me down a bit. But you know, to be fair, he'd served his country and he wanted that money so that it could be, you know, shared with his comrades or whatever. So, yeah, no worries there. I know Andy had a bit of problems in some places because Andy's an artist. And if you've seen the photos of Andy over the summer, he wore a, let's call it a flamboyant artistic hat. And in some of the southern places we went to, Texas, Springfield in Missouri, he wore pink shorts, kind of flowery shirt. He was wearing this, you know, flamboyant hat, ill-advised hat, in my opinion. And I think, you know, he got off on the wrong foot with some people just because he looked very different. But I find, John, with all these kind of places, you know, Texas and Kansas and Missouri, sometimes they're a bit frosty with you to begin with. But once, you know, once you start talking to them and they realize what you're there for, they're often some of the warmest people to you, you know, and the people that you really remember when the trip's over. So I hope I'm not speaking ill of the people in Springfield or in Fargo where the veteran was. But that is something to expect sometimes, that they'll look you up and down a little bit and, you know, try and work you out before they open up to you. But on the whole, Russell, they were incredible. The people over there, you know, I didn't have any trouble whatsoever. So, yeah, fantastic.
Great. And the next question is from Astros Fans UK, George Martin from the MLB UK community meetups. What was the overriding baseball-related thing which you learned from your trip? And a follow-up to that, did it justify the effort? That's a bit of a profound question. I like it.
Yeah, that is a difficult one, George. In terms of, I mean, every day for me is a school day, John, because I'm nowhere near the knowledge level that, you know, that you and Darius and Russell have. But one thing I did learn fairly consistently throughout the summer was I'd often sit, once the game started, the next day starting pitcher sits behind home plate or often in the press box with a speed gun and also a sheet of paper. And on that sheet of paper, they record every single pitch that the opposing pitcher and their own pitcher throws. And I got to a point where I was sat, I think I was at the Lancaster Barnstormers, and I was sat next to a chap called Jonathan Albert Ledejo. I'm sure I've mispronounced his name, but he used to pitch for the Yankees 2008 to 2010. He was with the New York Yankees. One of the worst trades that Brian Cashman ever made, according to his Wikipedia page, which is a bit harsh on him. But I sat with him and I would basically guess each pitch. So I checked with him beforehand, so it wasn't super annoying. But the pitcher would throw something and I'd say, slider. And he'd say, no, that was a curveball. And then I'd say, hang on, what's the difference between a curveball and a slider? And then he'd show me the speed readings for the, you know, for the previous pitch, which was a slider and not a curveball, and I'd notice. And, you know, that got quite interesting, where I was, you know, able to recognize pitches from behind home plate. Most of the time, I was able to identify them. I still find some of them, like cutters and sinkers, very hard to, you know, to kind of spot. But just sitting with the players each night, and it was pretty much each night, it was something that I kind of looked forward to. I'd look for the guy behind home plate with a gun and just go and, you know, pester him. And most of the time they didn't mind. So I learned a lot about pitching, having never thrown a baseball until I was at Gary, as I said, when I threw it from the mound. The other stuff, you know, kind of less baseball technique, but lots of the journalists told me that you need to speak to pitchers, not hitters. Pitchers, apparently, John, are far more interesting people to speak to. They're far more open with their thoughts and often more intelligent, apparently, allegedly. So that was something I was told early on, speak to pitchers. And that's something I tried to do when I was going around recording interviews with people. What the pitchers often told me was, stuff that I'd never heard before. And the hitters, in a way, you didn't want them thinking too much anyway, because you don't want them getting hung up on, being 0 for 21 or whatever. You just want them to focus on the next at bat. So I can see, I can kind of understand why there is that thinking. I'm sure it's not true, but pitchers, interesting bunch of guys.
Brilliant. I really like that. Next question is from Rob Newell. If you lived in the US, would you follow minor leagues, major league team, or indie ball?
This is a tough one from Rob. I'm actually looking. There was a place I stayed in the summer, and I kind of ran away there for about a week in the end, just to get away from it towards the end. And it's a small town in Kansas, southeast Kansas, called Independence, about 12,000 people there. If I had to live in the USA, that's where I'd live. That's where I'd settle. And I'd settle there because there's a Netflix series, actually, Last Chance U, the college football one. Season 3 is filmed in Independence, which is why I'd heard about it. But I've got a list of teams that are like within about a 5.5-hour drive from Independence. I've got the Texas Rangers, Texas Air Hogs, Cleburne Railroaders, Kansas City T-Bones, the Royals, the Tulsa Drillers, the new Marlins team moving to Wichita, Springfield Cardinals, Frisco Rough Riders, Northwest Arkansas Naturals, Oklahoma City Dodgers, the Cardinals, the River City Rascals, and one that I can't read my own handwriting about. So that's where I base myself, just because then I can cover minor league, independent, and major league. If you're really forcing me, it would be, I'd live in Overland Park, which is a suburb of Kansas City, because I love Kansas City.
There you go. That's a pretty comprehensive answer and a good question. Thanks very much for that, Rob. Alexander Wist, what was the strangest promotion you encountered on your travels? It's going to have to go some to be the office night where you threw out the first pitch, but was there anything in that ballpark? Excuse the pun.
The office night, I've not seen the American office. Again, come at me there. I've only seen the UK one, but they were having like the Dundies night or something. It's like an award night or an episode that where people get awards. So they were handing out all kinds of awards for, dirtiest car in the lot and, worst dressed and all that kind of thing, most drunk. It was all lighthearted, by the way, I should say, people weren't getting victimized here. But that was a good one. There was midget wrestling at the Kansas City T-Bones after the game, not before or during. Big crowd. That was a Saturday one, I think. Bark in the Park, I've talked about already with Who Let the Dogs Out. And it was a really quiet crowd. I was there about 2 hours before first pitch, and we were really worried that there weren't going to be any people there for this Sunday game. And then out of nowhere, probably about 50 dogs just walked out onto the field with all these, men and women and children, walked around the bases. One of them did a wee, and one of them did a poo by second base. So that was an interesting one, watching them clean that up afterwards. But for me, always the best promotions are dollar dog night, $1 hot dog, two of those, or dollar beer night. But most of the time it's $2 beer night. So any of those promotions are a winner for me.
I wonder why that was. Last question is from Teacher Dude. Last listener question, because I've got a couple more of my own, because I'm being, sure, being selfish. What was the most surprising characteristic of Americans which you hadn't anticipated?
Oh, my goodness me. That is a difficult one. Most surprising characteristic of Americans. I've got a couple about America. The laws.
Okay,
each state's got its own laws. So in a way, America, obviously, 50 states, it's a huge place. And I found that there were real differences. This isn't going to shock anyone, between people in California, for example, and people in Pennsylvania on the East Coast. So in California, you can smoke weed completely legally. It's advertised on buses. I went to one with a friend. I won't name him or her. But they, it's just a scan the passport. You go through detector, there's a security guard there, you go into like this kind of almost like a Starbucks kind of vibe with all these billboards up with different types of, I assume it's marijuana, different flavors and textures and things, and you can just buy it and they just give it to you in like a little tube, and that was bought legally, I should add, in California. But then we flew to Phoenix, and this person, him or her, kind of panicked at the airport and thought, oh my god, I've still got some of that marijuana left in that little tub and I don't know where it is. So he or she started frantically going through their bags, chucking stuff out before we went through the security guard. But already, checked in, so to speak, and now we were going through the metal detector and the security. and just dumped this weed in the bin right before the security guards. And just the sheer panic on his or her face was something I'll always remember and think, you've really got to know your laws in the US state. You can have a beer open in a car in Missouri, Kansas City side, but as soon as you cross over to Kansas City, Kansas, that becomes illegal and you can get arrested. So it's those little nuances. The toilets, they've got to sort out because there's a huge crack. Anyone's been to the States, you know that if you go to a cubicle toilet, they've got these really wide cracks down them where people can just walk in and see exactly what you're doing. So that was something that consistently surprised me, if that's the question. Something surprising that surprised me every time I forgot, and every time I was like, this is awful. The cops, I met a cop. I got stopped by a cop on the way from Denver, Colorado to Kansas City. The plains there, Kansas is so flat in western Kansas, and the winds were coming across. It was unlike anything I'd experienced. And as I've kind of already admitted, I'm a bad driver, or was. So I was, the wind kind of blew me slightly across the middle lane. And just as I came over a brow of a hill, and I'd been warned, you know, they'd kind of hide and they'll try and catch you. And there were two cop cars down there facing, each way on the road. And this car, you know, it was a nightmare, John. I kind of went past it, panicked as I came over the brow of the hill and saw this car, just as you instinctively do. I wasn't speeding or anything. And it went past it, thought, phew, you know, relief. And I think I was listening to your podcast, you know, the dulcet tones of Darius or someone, Tom Pringle, soothing me as I drove through Kansas. And then the sirens came on. Mm-hmm. And I had to double check it wasn't on the podcast, looked in the rearview mirror, and there's this huge cop, you know, like a big weightlifter bloke. And he made me pull over, came up to me. I've been warned already by a family friend, do not get out of the car if the police stop you. Because as soon as you get out of the car, they'll assume that you might be armed, and they will, you know, they might shoot you. So I just sat there, and he came along, and he asked me what I was doing, if I was okay, if I was tired. Just said I'd, you know, slightly come across the middle lane as I came over the brow of the hill. I said I wasn't used to the wind, and, you know, I'm sorry, and all that kind of thing. And then he started talking baseball, and I started telling him about bat flips and nerds and absolute bunts and about the MLB London Series. And then he got his, you know, he said, "Oh, you wait till I tell the guys back at the station." And he was really nice. I almost wanted to get a selfie with him, but sort of out of respect and, you know, for the situation, being on the side of a motorway, I decided against it. But I'd read a lot of bad things about cops in the newspapers, and, you know, that was my first real experience with one where it could have been hairy, and he was a lovely bloke. So that surprised me. Yeah, so that's that. Cops are good people, guys.
And mostly. Just a last couple of questions from me to wrap us up. Just about your reflections on the trip. And it sort of sounds like you've answered this question for, you know, the last hour or so. But did you get what you wanted out of this trip?
Yeah, corny as it sounds, I think I got more. I really do. I knew it would be fun. I knew, you know, people that follow along on Twitter. I was always quite careful. I hope I never rubbed it in anyone's face. I don't, oh, here we go again. I'm on the beers and I'm at a baseball game and you're, you know, back at work or whatever. But it was just as good as you would have thought it was. You know, if you clicked on, you know, Baseball Brit on Twitter and you saw what I was up to that day and it looked good, it was good. I'm not gonna lie about it. And as I said, I kind of got over the driving thing. Spent a lot of time with my friend Andy, who's a good lad. Got to meet a lot of fantastic people, saw a lot of America, which, you know, the United States of America is a fantastic country, very diverse. You know, people who were Trump supporters, people who were Democrats, people that smoked weed, people that were pimps, people that were Bible Belt, you know, kind of people. All these people were fantastic to me. And I learned a lot about the country through them. So, yeah, I got a lot more out of it, and I was not expecting, you know, the exposure that I got or the interest, really, certainly not the access. And I'm pumped now to hopefully go back next summer.
Yeah, so that was my next question. What's in the future? Is the planning already starting? You've said that you've got this job for the next 5 months and you've specifically asked them for that contract. Is there anything between now and then? And
there is.
What is then?
Yeah, so this contract I was able to negotiate very much on my terms because they're desperate. And my old boss did say that to me in the email. He said, you know, Joey, I know you're doing the baseball thing for a year, so, you know, be honest and upfront with them. So I still will be at the winter meetings, the baseball winter meetings in Las Vegas. Those are in 6 weeks, 6 weeks this Friday. So I'll be flying from Hong Kong to Vegas for that. I've got a lot of people that I've met on the road who will be attending. involved in professional baseball, independent baseball, minor league, major league, whatever. So looking forward to catching up with them, and hopefully, you know, learning a lot about what takes place at those meetings and getting some, you know, some pictures and getting some things up on Twitter. And tie me down on this one, John. I need to write something for Bat Flips and Nerds about it, for, you know, for sure. So I've got that coming up. There's SABR, the Society for American Baseball Research. I got in touch with them. One of them used to be the assistant general manager of the St. Paul Saint that I visited, and now he's the CEO of SABR. So I got to know or got introduced to Scott online, and he's really keen for us to revive the Bobby Thompson chapter, which is an existing UK SABR group, which hasn't been active since 2011, according to the website. So he's going to give us as much support as we want. And that's something that I'll be planning and hoping to get up and running whilst I'm working still out in China, you know, the SABR thing. So we've got the winter meeting, SABR, and then next March, hopefully I'll be at MLB opening day, which is taking place in Tokyo in Japan. The Athletics are playing the Mariners about a week before the regular season starts in the USA. And that's, I think, a Wednesday and Thursday. And I'm going to speak to the boss and make sure I can get out there to cover opening day officially for Major League Baseball in Japan. And then once my contract ends on March the 31st, the only date I've got in the calendar, John, at the moment is the High Point Rockers, a brand new team for the Atlantic League Independent Baseball. They've got their first home game on May the 2nd, a Thursday, right by the Durham Bulls in that area of North Carolina. So that's the only thing on the schedule right now, but it'll be jam-packed full of independent baseball and Major League Baseball, minor league baseball come, you know, once all the schedules are out.
And 29th and 30th of June, when you'll be in London, I would hope.
London series, yeah. I am definitely back for that. And yeah, looking forward to you know, to meeting all of your listeners, I guess, who I really hope will be attending.
I hope so too. So the last question I have from you, when we spoke before, you had sort of accidentally let slip to someone that this might turn into a book. Is that still the plan, or is it now just, you know, living footloose and fancy free, as if there's anything wrong with that? Because there absolutely isn't.
The plan is still, I do live footloose, fancy free. You're right. You know, day to day. But whilst I was out there this summer, I think I've probably got about 60 hours of interviews on my recorder, which I've put onto my computer. And these people are people that, you know, work in Major League Baseball. They're general managers. They're some of the most interesting people to speak to are the clubbies, by the way. If anyone's planning a similar trip, top tip, try and interview the clubby, because they know these players, they know the coaching staff, they know the the whole operation, and they're very honest and upfront if you buy them a few beers. So I'm going to continue interviewing people as I travel around the country, and hopefully I'll get up to about 200, 300 hours of recording. A lot of these people I'll be revisiting, so it won't just be a one-off kind of, and then I went to this ballpark, and then I went to this ballpark. It'll be looking over, you know, teams for a couple, two or three seasons possibly. So yeah, that's something I'm still going to work on, but there certainly won't be any major book announcements in the next year.
Okay, so the best place to keep up with you, I guess, is over on Twitter. So where can people find you, Joey, if they want to carry on following the adventure?
Yeah, if people want to see what China looks like and, you know, the inside of a Las Vegas hotel, it's at Baseball Brit. Pretty straightforward as it sounds. And yeah, I'll try and post once or twice a day, even through the off season. So follow along and, you know, do get in touch in the DMs, always open.
DMs are open, particularly now you don't have a mustache. watch this space for the next chapter of the Baseball Brit adventure. I can't wait, mate. It's been an absolute pleasure, and don't ever apologise for having a brilliant time, as you attempted to very humbly earlier on in this podcast. That will earn you a slap on the wrist, whereas right. Boasting and having a few cold ones never will, mate. And we're really looking forward to seeing you again next June, if not before.
That's it, John. Yeah.
In Las Vegas.
I will. And I'll try and catch up with you and Tom again at Christmas if I can. But thank you.
Cheers, mate. And we'll speak soon.